You probably remember exactly where you were on that chilling day in 2014 when man Haron Monis held hostages in Sydney's Lindt Cafe. It ended badly with two innocent people dead. And after an inquiry, it was clear that much of the fault lay with how the siege was handled by authorities. Journalist Deborah Snow followed the story of the Lindt Cafe siege, from the event itself through to the coronial inquiry. Her new book, Siege, lays bare what really happened.
On the day, there were several factors in why the police basically adopted a kind of wait 'em out approach. The first was the bomb that he kept saying that he had in his backpack, even though a lot of the hostages had formed the view that they weren't really thoroughly convinced about that after a while, just because of the way he was moving around the cafe with this supposed load of explosives on his back. But the police kept saying, well, we could never discount the threat of a bomb, and they didn't. So that was certainly one reason for why they were reluctant to rush in. Another was the philosophy that they had of contain and negotiate, which had been their sort of decades-old philosophy of coping with the kinds of sieges they were more used to, which were sort of run-of-the-mill crims and domestic sieges and that sort of thing. And even though they, at the top level, declared it to be a terrorist incident, that did not kind of find its way into the operational philosophy around the siege. It just proceeded more as if it was just your standard domestic siege. And the third factor was poor intelligence, just not getting a clear enough reading of what was going on inside the cafe.
And to read also about in your book about the number of people that did know things about Monis and that could have spoken to him, that were making offers from behind the scenes, and so many phone messages, so much technological difficulty too in messages just getting through.
Yeah, there are two issues that I've sort of highlighted, that there were various intermediaries who made offers to, you know, including lawyers who'd worked with him in the past. He had a long record of getting himself caught up with the law, often through these bizarre sort of protests and things that he staged. So those offers weren't taken up. I think there was, again, an institutional philosophical reluctance by the police to do that. They kind of thought, well, you know, that's not something we're used to doing, and also we can't really control that interaction. That just didn't go down that route. And the intelligence, there were technical problems. The New South Wales Police technical branch was unable to get any surveillance of the cafe from the inside. They had cameras set up around the perimeter, but they weren't able to get surveillance devices, either audio or visual, into a position where they could pick up intelligence from inside the cafe, which was something that they tried to rectify later in the evening by borrowing a listening device from the Australian Federal Police, but because that had to go, the product from that had to go to the Australian Federal Police base before it went to the New South Wales negotiators who were elsewhere, there was this very clumsy transmission by text of information from the listening device that was not actually live. There was a delay on it. And so this contributed to the misreading of cues and just misinterpreting the mood in the cafe, and it was one of the reasons why, you know, Tory Johnson being on his knees for several minutes was never picked up by police commanders at the time.
They were aware of it though, weren't they?
They were not aware that he was on his knees. No, some of the police snipers saw it, but they say they made radio transmissions about that. The commanders said they never got transmissions to that effect, and also because the snipers' calls did not seem to get through. Police commanders would say after the siege that they were unaware that Tory had been on his knees for 6 or 7 minutes before Monis executed him.
Behind the scenes, you would call it a comedy of errors, except it wasn't comic, and you've had to deal...
A tragedy of errors.
Yeah. You've had amazing access to a lot of the hostages and to the families. How do they feel about the wash-up of what happened after the coronial inquiry too?
I had a varying degrees of interaction with hostages. In terms of the families, they came on board quite late. They were in two minds about, you know, going through it all again, understandably, but they did give me assistance at the end. And I would say that there is still anger, grief, of course, but still anger and a sense that maybe the inquest just didn't get to the bottom of everything. And, you know, there were a lot of legal hurdles that the coroner encountered where there were issues that were the subject of non-publication orders. operational, the police would claim operational sensitivity over this or that, and so that never saw the public light of day. And also, there was a whole hearing with ASIO in a closed court that's the subject of a secret part of the report that's never seen the light of day. So I think the families, initially there was a sense in the Dawsons that at least there was some of the fumbling and the missteps had been flushed out, but they don't feel that the inquest has got to the bottom of everything. So there's still anger. But I think the things that have improved, I mean, certainly the police have overhauled their commander training for those in charge of counterterrorism incidents. There's been re-equipment programs. There's been upgrades of training, and a change in mindset. And importantly, though, I think that there's also a realisation that there has to be more seamless interaction between federal and state agencies if something like this recurs. And this doesn't necessarily mean you call out the military straight away or even that you put the military in the front line. But it does mean that you would hope in future a state police force would be much more quick to draw in advice and possibly support from every federal agency that might be able to help them out. And that wasn't really evident on the night of the Lint siege.
Deborah Snow, author of Siege, speaking to The Wire's Annie Hastwell.